Blog Talk Radio.
Johnson tonight is going to discuss the recent trip to Pine Ridge Reservation, and we will be discussing their many issues centered around their Lakota people. And let's see, there's a couple of other things that may want to go to that. Tonight, Gail is also a very strong Palestinian activist. And she was on the one of the passengers on the flotilla to Gaza from the United States. And
the Audacity of Hope, the most recent
one. The Audacity of Hope, yeah. So, but it's really quite frightening what's happening over there, and there's not a whole lot of news on national or even on the internet. You got to really go to specific sites to get this. But Russian TV has got this one. It's called Gaza Will Be Unlivable by 2020 Unless Immediate Action Is Taken. And that was stated by the UN. Why will we read that?
Gaza will long ago be livable by 2012 unless urgent measures are taken to improve the area's water supply, power, health, and schooling, according to a UN report. Action needs to be taken right now on fundamental aspects of life, water, sanitation, electricity, education, health, and other aspects, UN Humanitarian Coordinator Maxwell Gaylord told journalists. Those services are not keeping pace with the needs of the growing population, the report states. The document predicts the population of the Gaza Strip will increase by 1.6 million people today, to 2.1 million people in 2020, calling into question whether the region can actually sustain such growth. At the moment, the region is suffering from its worst ever fuel shortage and power cuts, as well as unemployment levels of around 45%. But while the population grows, these problems are predicted to only get worse. Gaza's lack of clean drinking water should be the first thing that's addressed, according to UNICEF Special Representative Jean Goff. The report estimates a 60% increase in Gaza's future water needs. While urgent action is already needed to protect the area's existing water resources, Reuters says. At present, only a quarter of Gaza's wastewater is treated. The rest, including raw sewage, goes straight into the Mediterranean Sea. According to a report released in June by Save the Children and Medical Aid for Palestinians, the levels of water contamination in Gaza are around 10 times higher than what is deemed safe for consumption. However, many poor families have no choice but to drink that water. The coastal strip is extremely isolated due to an Israeli blockade, which Tel Aviv refuses to lift, claiming it prevents arms from reaching Gaza's governing Hamas organization. And until the blockade is lifted, Gaza stands little to no chance of improving its situation, especially since it doesn't have an airport or seaport. Despite their best efforts, the Palestinians in Gaza still need help. They are under blockade, they are under occupation, and they need our help both politically and practically on the ground, Gaylord said. Gaza is 80% aid dependent, relying on foreign funding and a tunnel economy which brings in food and construction materials and electronics and cars from Egypt. Excuse me. But the current amount of outside help won't be enough to sustain the region's needs, according to Gaylord, who has called on an international donor to increase their aid. By 2020, Gaza will need 440 more schools, 800 more hospital beds, and over 1,000 additional doctors, according to Robert Turner, Director of Operations of the United Nations Relief and Work Agency. urgency. But it's not just Gaza's lack of accessibility to supplies that contributes to its less than promising future. Gaza's border with Israel is tense, and the area is frequently hit by Israeli airstrikes, often leading to civilian death. Gaza will need to achieve both peace and security before the lives of its people can be improved. It will certainly have to mean, it will have to mean the end of the blockade, the end of isolation, and the end of conflict. But the goal of peace and security isn't likely to be achieved anytime soon. The Palestinian Authority currently refuses to negotiate with Israel, and unless the country agrees to a freeze on settlement buildings on the West Bank, something Tel Aviv will not do, even though the UN says that settlements go up against international law. That's a very disturbing article, really, very, very disturbing. I mean, certainly the human rights of these people are being constantly violated. There's also another article that I wanted to talk to you about. Certainly the economy in Europe is not that great. Okay.
I noticed they wanted to. The Israelis want to make the. They want to put Rachel Corrie on trial for her murder.
Yeah, isn't that something?
Absolutely disgusting. These people are unwilling.
Warning, here's an interesting article. Warning to activists, agent provocateurs want to make you a terrorist. I think this has always been true.
We've run into this problem before, and we've identified a number of these bastards that are out there, even in our own community. So,
this is from the IntelHub.com. For hundreds of years, the establishment has used agent provocateurs as a means of discrediting protest movements that spoke out against the injustice that was being perpetrated by the ruling class. Provocateurs are basically undercover agents who infiltrate activist groups and try to provoke or push various members of their groups into doing something illegal that they can then immediately be arrested for. Even if activists aren't arrested, the incidents can then be used as a propaganda piece against dissenters everywhere. This is how things have played out through the course of American history, and in sure it goes back much further than that. In the past, you could expect one of these snakes to be at protests, trying to get people to throw bricks through windows, or even just doing it themselves when all else failed. This usually supplied the pretense for violent crackdowns on protesters and a justification for the use of excessive force. However, in recent years, with the general population becoming more discontent, these provocateurs are taking more extreme measures and hatching plots that get innocent protesters sent away for life or even worse. I'm talking, of course, about the fabricated terror plots that the establishment has been walking people into since at least the signing of the Patriot Act. First, these plots were surrounding Muslims on airplanes with fake bombs. This trend continued for years and resulted in the prosecution of several people. These underwear bomber cases, as they later began to be known, served as the excuse for the expansion of the TSA and the rollout of the radioactive naked body scanners that have become so controversial. Since Occupy Wall Street became a household name, the government is now turning their attention away from the phony Muslim threat toward the dissenters at home who have now been branded domestic terrorists. This past weekend in Chicago, a group of young Occupy this is obviously an old article, or I think, when was this published? Let me think. May 24th, 2012. Yeah, so it is an old article.
They just arrested this militia group, supposedly, who wanted to kill Obama this weekend.
This past weekend in Chicago, this is what they're talking about, this happened in May, a group of young Occupy protesters were infiltrated by a federal agent who supplied them with all sorts of contraband and then immediately had them arrested. This setup with Neil are identical to one that took place just weeks ago prior to the May Day protests in Ohio. The police are putting forward a narrative about violent terrorist masterminds, when in reality it was the undercover agents themselves who put the plot into motion and provided all the materials. These incidents should serve as warnings to activists everywhere to keep their guard up and avoid people who start talking about this kind of sketchy activity. Many of you reading this probably think this should go without saying, but it's become apparent that it is very difficult for police to ensnare people in these false flag setups. It's not very difficult to ensnare them. This should be an issue that is discussed regularly at activist meetings and Occupy General Assemblies worldwide. While this may seem like a topic that should be unspoken and common sense, it is still one of the most damaging tactics that has been used against dissenters thus far, both in terms of public relations and the toll on the lives of those who get caught up in these traps. As we have seen many times in the past, hurting people, blowing things up, and destroying property accomplishes nothing for the cause of freedom. This kind of behavior actually provides the mainstream media with propaganda opportunities that will be used to perpetrate the myth that anyone who disagrees with authority is silent, is dangerous and violent. As long as the myth endures, the public will continue to fund and allow their own enslavement as well as yours and mine. From now on, we should all be especially careful about the kinds of things that new friends are bringing into our houses. If someone approaches you acting shady or offers to give you anything illegal, especially related to weapons or explosive materials, you need to get yourself out of that situation as smoothly as possible and don't accept anything that person is going to offer you. Try to disagree with them as politely as possible. If they mention anything about violence, anything that is said to an undercover cop will definitely come back up in court and be used to demonize the accused. With two cases like this popping up in two different cities so close to each other, it's quite possible that there are undercover units in activist movements in every city, especially the Occupy movement due to all the press that it got last season. Be careful out there and make sure your friends and local community members are aware that there has been widespread infiltration of protest movements and that they should be highly suspicious of people who start talking openly about violent or destructive behavior.
Yeah, we know they're there, that's for sure.
Oh, yeah.
They are out there, guys.
Sometimes their goal is to get you arrested and break up the group. Sometimes their goal is to just demonize you and your work.
This thing really freaked me out here, but this is in the EU. I mean, if anybody wants to know, they wonders what the hell is going on with that group, the European Union.
Oh, I read that on
isn't that bizarre?
What it is that they wrote this law so that people wouldn't use chemicals
to
get rid of slugs.
Yeah.
But the way it's written is that it means that you can't use anything organic either. It's written that you can only use tested materials to beat that kind of thing. So it's the way they're interpreting the law. It's the narrow interpretation of the law.
What people are doing here is sprinkling coffee, around their plants to kill slugs. Okay.
But if they sprinkle coffee around their plants to enrich the plant, it's not a violation.
But only to kill slugs.
But if you said you were sprinkling coffee around your plants to kill slugs, then it would be a violation.
Yes, as the homemade solution contravenes regulations on pesticides, it means that there's a chance, be it a slim one or a vegetable grower is receiving a visit and a heavy fine from the police. Gardeners say that the caffeine in coffee keeps slugs out of the vegetable patch. You got to remember that, because You know,
I had heard that before.
If you use beer, I guess. We're going to use some beer this year.
No. If you put beer in a container, what happens is they fall into it and drown.
Yeah.
It doesn't keep
them
out.
Drink it.
It attracts them.
They go in and they drink it and they drown. Okay. But anyway, so if you're in the EU, you know, be careful not to use
coffee grounds. Plants to keep slugs away. It's the way the law is written, Ben. Ridiculous.
It is bizarre. Okay. Let's see. This is another one that I like. I like this article. It's kind of interesting. The mass media illusion. Did you read this?
Yeah.
Did you read
it? It was okay.
Think or be eaten. That's the word.
Yeah. They showed a picture which was much better than the article.
I should not ask you to critique an article that I was about to read. Because then now you can't. For the people I know who are still sound asleep don't see anything going wrong. They are content and distracted, completely disconnected from the world that sustains them. They have no understanding of this, and they think their state of disconnection is actually being connected. What are they connected to? The mass media. Some folks sit in front of the television set for hours every day, and they will turn on the TV in the morning and leave it on all day, whether they're watching it or not. The TV is the last thing that gets turned off at night. When they do sit down to watch it, their favorite shows are interrupted every few minutes with groups of advertising trying to sell products to every conceivable kind. But this is the connection that they're trying to bring. It's kind of a long article.
Mm-hmm.
I'm gonna ask you if you're interested to read it, but it has a lot of fact to it, and
they're telling you to unplug from the mass media.
Yeah, the false media is so prevalent, folks. It's so amazing. I mean, tonight if you watch the news at all you've seen is the Romneys, okay? Mrs. Romney, I don't even know her name, and Isaac, okay? Storm Isaac in Louisiana.
With a slight more interest in Isaac.
With more interest in Isaac, yeah. What the hell is Mitt Romney's wife's name?
I don't know.
Maybe it's Mitty.
I don't know what her name is.
Miss Mitt. Okay.
Mrs. Romney. I don't know.
Yeah.
That was probably Mitt Romney's wife.
No one's gonna remember her after November anyway.
I don't think so.
Seven reasons to consider off the grid in the map of the past. The FDA approves sales of pills with RFID microchip.
And this was kind of interesting.
Was that a free
thing? Mm-hmm.
And folks, I tell you, and it's getting weird. If they can't implant it, they're gonna make you eat it.
Probably rings you from inside, pushes on your stomach and says, it's time to take your pill.
It's crazy stuff like that. So FDA approved sale of pills with RFID microchip. Beginning and end, the United Kingdom approving prescription pills that contain RFID microchips. Now the United States Food and Drug Administration has approved a similar ingestible RFID microchip medicine for use in the U.S. The Food and Drug Administration has approved an ingestible digital sensor. That can track physical health, with the assertion that patients are not taking their medication regularly and need a tracking device inside their bodies to assist them in their medical care. Well, Proteus Digital Health released the ingestion event marker, which has been first approved in Europe. George Savage, co-founder and chief medical officer of PDH, claims that his ushers in a new era of digital medicine that shifts the paradigm. The IEM is as small as a grain of sand, can be embedded in a pill and ingested to monitor the patient and their body health. The device will collect measurements such as heart rate, body position, and activity. The IEM's send a signal to your smartphone, which then transmits the data to your doctor. And actual real-time data about your biological makeup can be uploaded wirelessly. Isn't that amazing?
It is.
Yeah. Well, the RFID chip in the pill is being offered to help patients be more efficient with their medicine. As beginning and end has detail, society is becoming more and more indoctrinated into the acceptance, use, and desire of RFID microchips as a regular part of life. And all the while, the dangers of the intrusion into one's privacy are not taken into account as serious issues. Even those in favor of the RFID pills openly acknowledge the privacy issue involved. I personally don't want somebody knowing if I'm freaking taking my pill or not and monitoring my, you know, my every move.
Or other more private body functions.
Yeah, I mean, or monitoring my move, you know. About half of all people don't take medications like they're supposed to, says so-and-so a doctor in California. This device could be a solution to that problem, so that doctors can know when to rev up a patient's medication adherence. Well, you know the funny thing, if they're not taking the meds to begin with, no, what is a good doctor going to do? You know, give you more medication that you're not going to take? Well, Topol is not affiliated with the company that manufactures the device, Proteus Digital Health in Redwood City, California, but he embraces the sensor's futuristic appeal, saying it's like Big Brother watching you take your medicine. And now Big Brother will have a person's full medical profile, current health status and location, all stored in a computer network and tracked real time. The Bible prophecy that in the final years before the second coming of Christ, also known as the Great Tribulation, almost the entire world will be using a system that will track every citizen all over the planet. They can almost do that with, they can do that with GPS and cell phones now.
Yep.
And because of all, both small and great, rich and poor, free and bond, receive a mark in their right hand or in their foreheads. And no man might buy or sell, save that he had the mark of the name of the beast or the number of his name. Here is wisdom. Let him that hath understanding count the number.
Well, the problem is, all you do is
slightly touch it. It becomes, it goes off into another universe.
Anyway, that's hard to read that stuff.
Well, anyway, the guy's talking about the mark of the beast, but also he's talking about the RFID code are being offered as a solution to the hassle of keeping track of medications and taking incorrect doses. And here is an ad for the use of the product, and they have it now. But, you know, it's like, I don't think so. I mean, if you can't take it yourself, I don't think I need a damn thing to remind my doctor I'm not taking it. You know what I mean? Right? There's two reasons you're not taking the meds. One, they're either, you know that they're killing you, or two, you can't afford the damn things.
Well, you don't
want to
take them.
Yeah, you don't
want to
take them.
Or you're irresponsible with your health care, and that's your problem. I don't think I would want someone else telling me or forcing me to do something I didn't want to do.
No.
That's kind of in your personal sphere. I mean,
yeah.
I don't like that idea of being controlled like that. And being monitored when you're doing your most private things. No, thank you. Oh, his heart rate's up. He must be, you know.
It says that 99% take on the Republican National Convention. Politics is an elaborate chess match, and in St. Petersburg, one small strike was staged against the Republican National Convention on August 26th and revealed the thrust of President Obama's 2012 re-election strategy. As panicky Republicans canceled the first day of the convention on Monday because of the tropical storm Isaac, the focus on Sunday was the RNC welcome event at Tropicana Field. These days, no major convention event is complete without a counter-protest. And in downtown St. Petersburg, nearly 500 people gathered Sunday to march to the sport stadium and voice their displeasure at what is derided as the world's largest cocktail party. We're working on it, folks. Yes, the marbles of Apple. Okay.
Given the spitting rain and gusts, the turnout was better than expected, and given the months of police and press fights, that a mob of mayhem-wrecking anarchists would crash the RNC, the protest rally around Mirror Lake seemed more like a festive Sunday in the park. People milled about as Dave Rovick belted out crowd pieces like, "I'm a better anarchist than you." A handful of buses pulled up and disgorged more protesters who came from far away as Miami, New York, and Wisconsin. The rally and protest was organized by the Florida Consumer Action Network, a local grassroots organization focused on public policy issues. Few anarchists were in evidence. Apart from the scrum of fidgety black-clad youth who melted into the rally after drawing stairs, it felt like an Occupy-related event with a giant puppet of Romney tagged with the king of the 1% and chants of, "We are the 99%. Grabbing attention with his preacher cadence, Reverend Manuel Sykes, president of the St. Petersburg NAACP, announced, "I'm here to stop the corporate takeover of America." Sykes castigated our leaders who want to privatize Social Security, healthcare, education, and prisons. He blasted Mitt Romney for wanting to enrich the 1%, and he described the November presidential ballot in active terms. "We're not just fighting for the 2012 election, we're fighting for the future of America as we know it." On the fringes of the rally next to a pack of camouflage-clad sheriff's deputies, a pungent, hippie-looking gentleman with a Ron Paul 2012 sign dangling around his neck and a video camera taped to his helmeted head taunted the crowd, "Do any of these hippies here supporting Obama know Obama has dropped two times as many bombs as Bush?" His words stung one observer who yelled back that Obama has to do the bidding of Washington. The exchange captured the conflicting mindset of the Democratic base. Romney, Ryan, and the right are painted not unfairly as extremists who will hurt America, who will hurdle America back to the dark ages. But Obama, despite sitting in the Oval Office, is seen as powerless. The weather and fear-mongering no doubt cut down on the turnout, but one community organizer clued me into another factor. The organizer, who wished to remain anonymous, said, "A lot of people I work with don't have hope in national politics. There was an element of fear about the RNC. Can I even go outside with all the street closures and restrictions? There's definitely animosity toward Republicans. A lot of, and pardon me, fuck these guys, but my members also questioned what was going to be accomplished by going out in front of the barricades. I've learned a lot of it's not going to change anything." The anti-RNC event was labeled as a community vigil, and it was strikingly diverse. There were anarchists, socialists, libertarians, and unaffiliated radicals. Mostly it was white middle-class liberals, working class African-Americans, and a collage of poor people. There were numerous T-shirts and signs indicating support for Obama. What united the crowd was the 99% rhetoric. "That was by design," the community organizer said. "The word from on high was, don't say working class, don't say poor, say middle class or 99%. "Why 99%, I asked? "Because it polls well," the organizer explained. The Occupy Wall Street movement lives on from student debt campaigning and labor solidarity to home closure defense and anti-fracking organizing. But as a national force, Occupy has been reduced to a bogeyman police and politicians dangling in front of a lapdog media that dutifully report every outlandish allegation as stone-cold truth, and it exists as a mobilizing force for the Democratic Party.
I'm going to call him. Yes, sir.
So, but this is what's going on.
Hello?
You can get that at alternate.
Yeah.
Hello?
Hi, Gail. How are you?
Hi, both. I'm fine. How are you guys?
We are very well.
Great.
We're calling you tonight to find out if you can tell us a little bit about your trip to the Pine Ridge Reservation. And first of all, tell us who sponsored the trip and what was your goal of going there.
Oh, all right. There's a lot of noise on this line. Am I coming across okay? Can you hear me?
Yeah, you're clearer than you've ever been.
Oh, wow. Okay. Well,
we're happy. Your voice is coming through well.
But you both sound very fuzzy.
Oh.
That's probably because of the fan.
What?
How's that?
Not good.
Oh, really? Now you sound clear as a bell. Can you hear me all right?
I can hear you, but I could not hear Leo.
Oh, okay. He'll just speak up a little louder.
Okay.
So tell us who sponsored your trip to the Pine Ridge Reservation and what your goal was going there.
Well, it was all very interesting how it came about. Back in July, there was, we start in June. On June 16th, a white buffalo calf was born in Goshen at a bison farm owned by Peter Fay. And some local people in Cornwall who are associated, who have actually been adopted by Lakota family on Pine Ridge, got the word out about the birth of this calf, and it's a very sacred event. And so in July, a medicine man, Lakota medicine man by the name of Steve Stonearrow, and some Lakota elders came to Goshen to perform ceremonies before a special ceremony to name this white buffalo calf.
Mm-hmm.
And in one of the ceremonies, and I took part in the ceremonies. It was the first time, even though I've been writing for Indian Country Today Media Network for 7 years and have been all over Indian Country all that time, this was the first time that I took part in the ceremony.
Mm-hmm.
One was a sweat lodge, which was a miraculous, wonderful thing, and the other ceremony was called the Lawampi, which is a night prayer ceremony where the medicine man called the spirits and received the name of the white buffalo calf. And the name is Yellow Medicine Dancing Boy. And those ceremonies were done on Friday night. And the next day, the Saturday, I think it was July 28th, there was the naming ceremony itself, which took place on the bison farm in Goshen. And some estimate that over 2,000 people showed up.
Wow.
From all over the country. Anyway, it was quite remarkable, and I did a bunch of stories about this. I did 4 stories, and one of them was an interview with the medicine man on Sunday night. And after the interview, I said to him, you know, I've been wanting to go to Pine Ridge for a long time. And he said, well, come on, you're invited any time. But, you know, he lives in California, and I'm like, yeah, right, I'm invited, but how am I going to, you know, how can I go? I don't know anybody there, and it just seemed unlikely. And when I came home, I told my husband, you know, I really want to go to Pine Ridge. And he said, well, why don't you go? It's like the same thing. Well, you know, how am I going to go? I don't know really what to do. The next day, I had to go to Boston to cover an event. And my husband sent me an email later in the day saying, I ran into so-and-so with the United Church of Christ in Cornwall, and they take a group to Pine Ridge every summer, and they're going in a couple of weeks, and 2 people who were supposed to go can't go, have dropped out, so there's a place for you to go if you want to go. So it was like, wow, you know, I wish the rest of my life worked that way. I say I want to do something, and the next day it happens, right? So that's how I got to Pine Ridge, and I went with the United Church of Christ Cornwall group, and
mm-hmm.
They went to an organization called Remember. It's re-member, and it's re-member.org on the internet. And what it is it's a volunteer organization that works with the Oglala Lakota people on Pine Ridge. They're nonprofit. They're nonprofit. They're non-aligned. In other words, they're not political. They're not religious. And they've been there for 15 years, and they have really built a place for themselves there, with some difficulty because the executive director, this guy Ted Gantz is his name, is like this tall, blonde, blue-eyed, white guy, right? And not easy for a tall, blonde, blue-eyed, white guy to create an organization that is easily accepted on Pine Ridge, because experience with tall, white, blonde, blue-eyed guys is not really lovely historically. But he's created this organization that is just really quite amazing.
What was the state of the reservation when you got there?
Well, the land is unbelievably beautiful. I just could not believe how gorgeous the northern plains are. It's this rolling grasslands. There's a drought there, so everything was like blonde, like hay. You know, there's very few trees. There are these areas where you can see the trees follow a water line, but there's no water in the streams and stuff. Very, very drought conditions. But I was wondering why we drove around, like, what was so incredibly beautiful, apart from the land itself? And I suddenly realized there's no clutter of signs, no billboards, no signs anywhere. I mean, there's an occasional speed limit sign, but there's no visual clutter. There's just this gorgeous, gorgeous land. And so that was so impressive. So what this organization does, this Remember organization, is it brings delegations for a week at a time. Maybe some people may stay 2 weeks, I'm not sure. And what we did all week was we built outhouses and bunk beds for Lakota families who are incredibly poor. It's the poorest place in the United States. And so these people, a lot of them don't have electricity or plumbing in 2012, right?
Mm-hmm.
Richest country in the world, and these people.
Pine Ridge was noted by the UN representative who went there as being a third world
country.
Yeah. I'm having a really hard time hearing you, Leo. I don't know why. Are you doing
something? I don't know either. That's okay.
Did you hear what Leo said? UN representative said that Pine Ridge is like a third world country.
Right, James Anaya. Yes, he visited there. And yes, it is like a third world country. And in fact, I told my husband when I came back, the conditions there are worse than the refugee camps in Palestine that I stayed in.
My God.
Oh. Yeah, yeah. I mean, the houses in Palestine, at least they have electricity and plumbing when the Israelis don't cut their electricity off and their water off.
Read an article before you came on that Gaza will be uninhabitable
in 2020.
By 2020.
Unless things change.
Yeah.
Right. Well, that's what the Israelis would like. They would like all the people in Gaza to go away and die, you know, it's like... That's what they would like.
Well, the reason that it will be inhabitable is because they expect another 400,000 or 500,000 people to be born there.
Right.
You know. Yeah,
well,
but
that wouldn't be so bad, except that they can't leave. They can't go anywhere.
Oh yeah, no, they can't.
Yeah.
Yeah,
water
they can't,
is polluted.
They can't.
It's like an outfit. It's like a prison.
Is what
it is.
Yeah.
You know, it's a concentration camp, and certainly the conditions are horrific there. And you said the conditions are worse at Pine Ridge?
Yeah, they are. I mean, with the exception that at least the Lakota people can move around and they can leave.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're not walled in and fenced in, and they're not being shot every day. But But, you know, they have other problems. They have huge, you know, epidemics of, well, the worst problem is this suicide, the number of young people who are committing suicide. And every speaker that came talked about that, and it's horrible. It's horrible. Young people as young as 9, 10, 11 years old committing suicide because they just, they can't see beyond it, you know, they can't see a future.
What does the Bureau of Indian Affairs do about this? They're supposed to be the custodians of Indians, right? And to have federal monies to improve the lives of Indians, I thought.
Yeah, right. Well, the tribal government gets millions of dollars a year from the federal government, but there's no telling what it does with it. I mean,
well, what happens to the money?
Well, I don't know.
Tribal government gets it. Where do they go?
I have no idea because they're not, certainly not. Well, let's see. They had a celebration, a ribbon cutting for this multi-million-dollar building, government building for the housing department, big, large, modern building. But the people are living in FEMA trailers that were supposed to be temporary back in 1996, and you know they have plastic garbage bags for roofs, and they have holes in the walls the size of basketballs, and they're up on these sort of you know, they're raised on these cinder blocks or whatever. One of the jobs that Remember does is it puts insulation and skirting around these trailers, which helps cut the cost of heating in the winter by 40-50%. So I don't know what the money, and no one, not a single person that I met or talked to or who came and talked to us had anything good to say about the Pine Ridge tribal government.
And there's no way people can do anything about that?
Well, do they vote them in, or are they, or how are they?
Do you know how that government?
Yeah, they're voted in every 2 years, I think. But you know, it's like people don't
like our elections.
Yeah, except that I don't think they reveal how many votes anybody got. I mean, usually when there's an election,
they don't count the votes.
Well, they may count them, they may not, but nobody knows. It's, you know, the same is true here at Mashantucket. They have elections, but they don't say, they say who won, but they don't say what the vote result was.
Okay.
I find very bizarre. I mean, I think that is strange, you know?
Yeah, it is. It's very strange. Very, very strange. But where do they, so what recourse do these people have other than to shoot themselves?
Well,
now, can they get out of there? I mean, can they leave the reservation and take their families with them? Or
they have nowhere to go.
Where would they go, first of all? And second of all, they don't want to leave. It's their land. It's their land.
Well, I understand that, but it just seems like, you know.
There's no, what Leo was saying is there's no opportunity there on their land.
Can they go other places?
But if they don't know, if you don't know anybody, you can't, and you have no money, you can't go anywhere.
Unemployment.
So it's very difficult.
Unemployment is as high as 90% sometimes.
Is there any solidarity with other Indian tribes who would help them?
I think, you know, some other tribes do help Pine Ridge, like the Shakopee Medawankatan, whose chairman just died last Saturday. There, the Shakopee is an incredible tribe in Wisconsin, I'm tempted to say.
How many people actually live on the reservation?
I think something like 40,000.
40,000 people live there?
I didn't realize there were so many people there.
I think that's the number of people living there, and it's.
That's a small city.
But they
but
have
it's all spread out.
No casinos,
you know?
Right?
They do have a casino. I didn't see it, but it's like, you know, it's Nowheresville, USA. You know,
So nobody goes there.
Well, I think it's near the border of Nebraska, or maybe near Rapid City. But I don't, you know, I don't think the casino is any great shakes. It's no Foxwoods or Mohegan Sun, you know.
Oh, so,
yeah.
Oh, how much land? How large is their reservation?
It's pretty big. It's like I should know this, but I'm thinking it's like 2 million acres. Is that possibly correct? But you know what? Half of it is privately owned by non-natives. And I'll tell you how that happened. Back in 87, I guess, this guy Dawes passed the Allotment Act. It's notorious. What they did was they wanted to basically grab Indian land. So they said,
hey, could you speak up just a little bit?
Yeah, this Dawes Act, they wanted to grab Indian land.
Uh-huh.
They said, oh, we don't want you to be Indians anymore. We want you to assimilate and have all the benefits of being Americans, right?
Uh-huh.
So instead of having tribal land owned communally, they broke it up and gave like 160 acres to each head of the household, men, that is. Women weren't given the land initially. And so once the land was broken up and they were given deeds to these lands, of course they had to pay tax on it, right? But they couldn't pay tax because they didn't have any money. So white guys came along and bought it up, and that's how they lost so much of the land. And so there's still like half of whatever, however much land they have, is owned, I was told, is owned by non-natives.
Now, are there any minerals or resources on their land?
There's one of the biggest aquifers in America, I understand, is under the Pine Ridge, and there's attempts now to tap into it for a pipeline, a water pipeline to send to other places.
Soros will be interested in that. He's bought up all the water rights everywhere, isn't it,
yeah.
Soros?
Soros,
yeah.
Yeah. So people are resisting that, you know. I'm sure there are other minerals there. I'm sure there are. I don't know if there's oil, but in North Dakota, I think there is oil in North Dakota, so... You know,
yeah.
I mean, so much of this country's resources are on Indian lands, and, you know, they've been raping these lands for years now with corporations and tribal governments, you know, getting in bed with these corporations. And
now, did you get a chance to meet with some of the elders or the people and get an idea if they have any hope?
This is the strange thing about the Lakota people. In spite of all the drug, you know, epidemic of drug abuse and suicides and the dismal poverty, they have this amazing, I don't know what you would call it. I mean, it's spirituality, I guess. You know, they actually have hope that things can improve, that the world can improve, and I think it comes from their ceremonies, you know. I mean, a lot of these Lakota people are very traditional, and they perform ceremony all the time, and the ceremony is what, you know.
Now, the Lakota, do they have a prophecy for end time, or is just the Hopi? The Hopi have a phenomenal prophecy that's coming due now, but or most of it has been fulfilled. But
no, I haven't heard of any end time prophecy. In fact, the coming of the white buffalo baby is a big sacred event that. It's a prophecy that indicates, you know, good things. So I don't know. I didn't hear of any end times prophecy.
No, because the Hopi, they have already three quarters or more of their prophecy has come true already, and in the last 100 years or 200 years, and. The only thing remaining for the Hopi is the return of the red planet and blue planet, which they expect in the next they expect by 2012 or within the next year to 2 years.
What do you mean the return? What do they mean the return of the red planet?
The red planet is the Hopi.
Mars?
What's that?
Mars?
It's actually not Mars. Helenus was the comet that was sighted as the Red Comet, which was seen this year, all right, the early part of this year. And now the blue planet, they predict, is the planet Nibiru, which they've already
comes through our orbit,
so we'll see it. But these are the two, these two are the last signs. Okay, the sign of the end times, where the, as the Hopis.
As the Hopis understand
right.
it.
So the Elenis was the red planet and comet, actually. And Nibiru is the final blue planet, which is supposed to be coming into our orbit within the next year.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it should be the Hopi prophecy is just about complete.
But the Lakota people, you're not aware that they have any prophecy?
Well, not of the end times, no.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, is there any industry or any kind of business or anything on the reservation that helps make money for these people?
No.
No,
People have, some people have cattle. Some people have buffalo.
Mm-hmm.
There should be more buffalo, I think, because that's where they live.
But how about, like, stores or shops or little factories or anything?
Well, there's stores. Not really. I didn't really see any stores. I mean, there's a 24-hour convenience store, restaurant type thing in the village of Pine Ridge. There's another convenience store at something called Sharp's Corner, which is, one of the. There aren't that many roads. There's a few roads that everybody takes to get everywhere, but everything is so spread out.
Really?
Yeah, it takes hours to get from anywhere to everywhere. And
did you see a school or churches?
We went to the Oglala Lakota College.
Mm-hmm.
They have this college; it's a tribal college, and that's pretty nice. We went to the bookstore. We spent money everywhere. We went to the visitor center, the White River Visitor Center, which is where the National Park Service and the tribal government co-manage the Badlands National Park.
Oh, okay.
We went to the Badlands on Sunday. They call it the Badlands, but...
And why is that called the Badlands?
That's the English translation, and I'm just looking up what the Indians call it. They call it something about...
I wonder why they called it that.
Well, because it's very, very, it's rough. It's very, it's amazing, actually. They call it the Land of Changing Earth.
Oh.
Which the English translated into Badlands.
Oh.
Anyway, there's a story about it. I did a story about this Lakota woman who works for the National Park Service. It's on Indian Country Today. .com, and I also posted a video about the Badlands, about the Indians.
What it is, and
yeah, but what the Indians want, they want it back. They don't want the National Park Service to be.
And what do you think, if people are listening to this show, and they want to help, what could they do for the Lakota people?
Well. One way they can help is through re-member.org.
Okay.
They can support that organization. Another really important thing, you may have heard, this week, the Black Hills are the most sacred site to the Lakota people. And they're just not in the reservation, but... They were given to the Lakota people in 1868 in the Treaty of Laramie.
What treaty, Gail?
It's the Treaty of Laramie, I believe. Hang on.
Oh, okay.
Let me just find.
You can talk a little louder too.
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, that's better.
Yeah. So
I just want to find this story that I did on Wounded Knee. 1868 Treaty of, I believe it was Laramie, famous treaty. that
the
American government promised the Black Hills to the Lakota people forever, you know, as long as the grass grows and the rivers flow and all this stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
So a few years later, I'm just calling this up right now and I can give you more information. A few years, like less than 10 years later, the people, they found gold in the Black Hills, and it was the gold rush, right?
Yep.
So of course they took the land back, and so these are the most sacred sites to the Lakota, and there are several sites where they worship, where they, you know, perform ceremony, but this one site in particular called Peshla, I'm trying to find that story too, is I think it's at the highest point of the Black Hills, and somehow it's, I say, owned in quotation mark by this family. It somehow fell into the hands of this family, and they were putting it up on the auction block. It was supposed to be auctioned last Friday, the day that we were leaving. And I'm just looking for that story right now. And they canceled the auction, but the tribes, the different Lakota tribes, you know, there are like six or different reservations, Rosebud and Cheyenne Sioux tribe and a bunch of different others, they were trying to raise money, and they figured they would have to raise between $6 and $10 million.
How much?
Between $6 and $10 million.
Wow.
To buy back the land that is theirs anyway, and it's theirs, you know, the federal government and the U.S. Supreme Court admit that it's theirs and that it was wrongly taken, and yet this private family owns it, and they were putting it up for sale. Well, everybody made such a fuss about it that they canceled the auction, and putting it up on a for private sale. So the tribes made an offer. I think today I saw a story. But we don't know how much they offered or what the result is. But what I found out was that the Lakota, have this amazing cosmology and knowledge of knowledge of the stars, of the heavens. So that's the other thing. Out there, because the land is so without trees and stuff, and the hills are just undulating rolling hills. The sky The sky is enormous.
Yeah, and big sky country.
Big sky country.
That's what they call that.
And so their ancestors have studied the sky for millennia, and they have this whole cosmology and knowledge of like sacred geometry and math and all of the universal knowledge that other ancient societies like in the Middle East and the Far East have about the sky, about the you know, the Milky Way and all of this stuff. And this is what Ruth Hopkins, the columnist for Indian Country Today, said. This Peshla is called the heart of everything. And not only does this sacred site play a key role in our creation story, it is said to be the place where the morning star plunged to earth and saved people from seven creatures who had killed seven women. The Lakota hero then placed those women in the night sky as the seven sisters, which is called the Pleiades, right, by Western astrologers.
Pleiades. The Subaru.
Pleiades, yeah.
The Subaru car.
Yeah.
I wanted to say, we got 15 seconds. We'll go off the air, but we're going to be recording. But I wanted to let people know about your articles and about Indian Country Today, and you know, and what's the online magazine?
You can just go to www.indiancountry.com, and that'll get you there to Indian Country Today Media Network. Yeah.
Right.
And if you search on white buffalo and do another search on Peshla, it's P-E apostrophe S-L-A, you'll find all these stories.
That's great. So, well, thank you so much, Gail, for being with us tonight. We appreciate the story.
Yeah, you're welcome.
And it sounds like you had a fascinating trip, and I urge people to read your articles and to help these people that who so desperately need help. And it sounds like they're the custodians of some ancient knowledge as well.
They are. They are indeed. And ancient spirituality.
Yeah.
I mean, they just see the interconnectedness of everything. Creation.
Amazing.
And the responsibility that we have to treasure it and be thankful.
And to treasure them as a people.
Are there any unusual is there any unusual architecture there? I know you're building outhouses and stuff, but I mean, is there any primitive stone architecture or any?
Yeah, there are petroglyphs and other sites. You know.
Right.
Yeah, definitely. Absolutely.
Well, it sounds like you had a great opportunity to learn some new things.
Yeah.
It's amazing, and I'm so honored that I was able to go, and so grateful that I was able to go.
Yeah. Well, we're thankful for you and for sharing that with us, wish you the very best.
Thank you.
All right, and thanks for being with us, Gail. We'll talk to you again soon.
Okay, thanks a lot.
All right, thanks.
Have a good night.
Yeah. That was Gail Corey-Tonsing talking to us about her trip to Pine Ridge and the Lakota people. And thanks for listening tonight, folks, and being with us. And we'll talk to you tomorrow night.
Tomorrow we'll be bringing the union issue. We'll be sharing with you some union news and other fascinating news.
So good night.